This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
To the good doctor.
Can I just say the coffee's coming? I'm sorry. I'm slightly flustered, and can I explain why?
Why are you flustered, Doctor?
The new Underworld movie
opens
today, and of course they decided...
Sorry, Michael Sheen.
Michael's in it, yes. They decided not to show it to the critics. And what that
what, a good sign.
And let me explain what happens when they don't show a film to the critics. What happens is that we all have to find out the first screening on Friday morning, and then we have to go to the cinema and pay our way into it. And we all sit together in a kind of, you know, little cadre, and you know, and watch the film.
What?
Cadre, okay. A Pharisaic cadre, and
a
watch
Pharisaic
it.
Cadre. Mm. How would I know? Just on that point.
Yeah.
How would I know if I was ever in a Pharisaic cadre?
Well, you have to be admitted.
Okay.
You know, it's the backpack. It's me and Nigel Floyd and Alan Jones. And,
oh, right.
You know,
just
you know,
that lot.
That lot.
And that's a Pharisaic.
That's right.
Okay,
and so you have to go to the first screening because, you know, obviously your nose is going to slightly put out of joint.
Because you've had to pay money.
Yeah, but actually that's not the thing that...
Who would have thought you
had to
pay money to see a film?
That's not the thing that really puts your nose out of joint. The thing that really puts your nose out of joint is that if it's on at The View in Leicester Square, the first screening is 10:30. It means you can go and see it. You can get in time to prepare yourself, right? If, as it was today, it was on at the Trocadero... The programme starts at 10 past 12. The film doesn't start till 12:30. It means you've got to run out of the film, run onto the tube, because obviously you do try to keep up with us. So that's why I'm slightly at sixes and sevens, because I've run from the first public screening of Underworld, Rise of the Lycans.
Well, yeah, or I mean, Keith in Edinburgh says, Dear Andy and Red, as long-time listener, I do enjoy my weekly fix of wittertainment. Today I'm looking forward to the good doctor giving underwhelmed Rise of the Lychees the tongue-lashing it surely deserves.
Well, isn't it good, therefore, that I did? Because actually there was a point at the 10 past 12, I don't even know if I can get this in from the programme, but somebody sent, Nigel Floyd, who was on the programme earlier on, and you referred to him as the oft-quoted Nigel Floyd, sent an email to me saying, Marcus, the first screening of Rise of the Lycans is on at 12:30. The email was intercepted by the good lady Linda, who said, Nigel has sent you an email about a movie called Rise of the Lichens. What, is that like The Growth of Moss? So it is now, you know, Underworld 3, the Mushroom Revolution.
Dear Tiny and Keop, I was wondering if the good doctor had a chance to clock the poster for Underworld 3.
Yeah. I have, yeah.
It might be subtitled Rise of the Machines or Attack of the Clones. I can't quite remember.
Yes, exactly.
It says
exactly
Critical Bill. The poster appears to display an image of Kate Beckinsale's character from the first two movies, but on closer inspection, she doesn't appear to be listed as one of the main actors in the credits below. Further digging on the Internet Movie Database reveals that the main actress in the current movie, Rona Mitra, looks very much like Ms. Beckinsale, and I wondered if the distributors were playing on this fact to suggest to the casual observer that the former star would again be featuring. Does this herald a new trend in marketing? Given that distributors are now prevented from quoting sections of reviews out of context, perhaps the new strategy is to suggest that stars of former movies will feature prominently, when in fact they've just employed a reduced price lookalike.
Well, here's what we're going to do. I don't want to preempt the Underworld review, because obviously that is, that
you brought
is coming
it up.
I did, but I brought it up, and that's pretty much
that where it's going to be. So we'll come to that.
Because it's a big Michael Sheen week.
It is. And Michael, when he was on the programme, people have heard in the course, he said, I'm trying to work out what the headline would be if they're reviewed together, what the headline would be if you do Frost Nixon and you do Underworld. And his conclusion was...
Frost Lycan.
No, he thought...
Me no Lycan.
Frostbites.
Frostbites.
See, that works for
both. That's very good.
On the subject of interference, Simon in Manchester, because there is interference in some areas on 909...
But not
on
693
and not on digital. And Simon says, I'm listening on digital, but I keep getting interference from my 2-year-old daughter who wants to play pop-up pirate. Can your engineers do anything about that? We'll have a word, actually. Maybe they could pop round and play pop-up pirate with Simon's 2-year-old.
What is pop-up pirate?
It's a game, I'm imagining.
Okay,
the pirate.
Fun. And you're down with the kids, aren't you, Simon?
At appropriate points,
yes.
It pops up, this pirate.
I see.
That's what I mean. A couple of emails about movies that are no longer in the box office top 10.
Okay. So you want to do that first, because they're not going to be in the box office top 10?
No, well, I just think they're worthy of attention, because I think it's the first week that these films haven't been in the 10, but they're still around somewhere.
Yeah.
This from Amber. Grade 10 ice skating badge and high predicted GCSEs. Dear Rosie and Jim. Now, there was a class show.
There was a class show.
I can hear the song now playing.
Okay, go on.
If I was listening on 909,
can you
I'd
do
like...
It?
Rosie and Jim, McDoll.
No, you can't do it. You can't.
The passing of years. Yeah. I know it's too late, but can Mark stop being quite so nice to Twilight, or Twiglet, as we call it? As a teenage girl, says Amber.
That's the ace card. In any discussion of Twilight, the ace card is, as a teenage girl, because it means that we all have to step away from the package because...
Exactly.
Okay.
As a teenage girl not entirely brainwashed, I was shocked that Mark didn't notice the blatant sexism. Bella Swan is an anti-hero for feminists. She pathetically waits to be rescued after unconvincingly falling head over heels for Edward, who, if he wasn't so boring, would be an interesting study on abusive partners. Mark, usually the first to condemn misogyny, has been annoyingly short-sighted on the matter, dismissing Stuart as moany. All this aside, for a vampire movie, Twiglet was blander than bland. Come on, girls, we deserve more than this.
Well, the two things I'd say is, I don't think... I mean, I absolutely take your point about, I hope, you know, being down on movies that are misogynistic. I don't think Twilight is, because I think that it comes from a long and honourable tradition of sort of gothic angst, which has long been pioneered by female writers, incidentally. I also think that I enjoyed Twilight much, much more than I expected to, and clearly lots of other people do.
Indeed.
But that said, obviously, if you're putting it on the great scale of, is it as good as Near Dark? No.
No. I did mention this opinion to my 15-year-old daughter.
She said if you said anything bad about it, you were leaving home or something.
Well, I said I had this. I've had this email from a teenage girl who calls it Twiglet and says, stop being so rotten.
Twiglet is funny, though.
Twiglet's quite good. And my daughter said, she's so got no friends. That's exactly how she said it as well.
All right. Okay.
Mark in the Wirral, dear Simon and the Doc. I haven't been to the cinema for a while due to lack of decent films. I got dragged to see Australia. Yes, all of it.
All of it. Very good, very good.
Recently by my better half. I'd like to point out that I don't like soppy romances. I don't like Nicole Kidman. I don't like Hugh Jackman or large-scale melodramas. And having read all the reviews that slated the film, my expectations were not high. And guess what? I loved it.
Good.
A fantastic night at the cinema. My enthusiasm for the cinema fully restored. Last week we went along to see the much touted, now unbelievably 10 Oscar nominated Slumdog Millionaire, or as it says in the movie, Millionaire.
We're referring to it as Slumdog Squarepants.
And guess what? It was terrible, says Mark.
What?
Wooden acting.
What?
Unbelievable script, totally unengaging. We were bored within 20 minutes.
Unbelievable script, totally unengaging.
Yeah.
It's a fable. It's a fable. I've had this out with so many people. So many people have said
to me...
What
is it?
That it's a fable.
It's a fable.
Yeah, no, and it's literally people go, oh yeah, I saw that Slumdog Millionaire. That would never happen. That would never happen. It's like my oft-quoted thing about, you know, sitting in the cinema next to Nick Cooper watching Eraserhead and him saying that would never happen. It's a fable. It's not meant to be real. I mean, it has realism, but it's not meant to be real. It's not a documentary. It's a fable, the whole point about it. It's like Shakespeare. Have you seen any Shakespeare? You know that bit when somebody puts on a horse's head and pretends to be a different... That wouldn't happen. No, it wouldn't.
Is it a fable as well?
That's a fable as well. That Midsummer Night's Dream, I saw that. It's rubbish. That would never happen.
The engineers...
That King Lear, rubbish. Can't pull...
Our 909 engineers, because we have different engineers. We have 693 engineers and 909 engineers and digital engineers. And the 909 engineers have been called out like a SWAT team, and they fixed, apparently. Well, Neil in Wembley says the music stopped, and it stopped mid-U2 Sunday Bloody Sunday.
Yeah, well, that's very good. Do you see that, Tempest? It's rubbish. That would never happen.
I'm particularly looking forward to the Culture Show U2 special. So what we have is a box office top 10. Madagascar, Escape to Africa, at 10.
Yeah, not as good as the first Madagascar, which still, for me, was not as good as everybody else thinks it is, except for Sacha Baron Cohen's bit, yeah. Which are the best bit.
Yes Man at 9.
No Man.
Right.
Only going to do that, guy.
I know, I'm kind of bored with it.
No, but exactly is how I feel about the film. Because, you know, the worst thing about the film is it's not terrible. It's just terribly average.
The Wrestler is at 8.
I think probably the highlight of Marisa Tomei's day yesterday...
Speaking to us.
...was being woken up by a friend to say you've been Oscar-nominated, followed by being rung up by the BBC so that I could explain The Wrestler to her. And I'm sure that...
I could tell in her voice she was thrilled.
She was. I'm sure that she then rang and said, you know, two great things have just happened to me. One of them is I'm up for an Oscar, but the most important thing is some British film critic explained my role in the film to me. And I could say nothing other than yes.
And on that subject, Marcus in London, BSE ONS, BN ONS, 25-metre swimming badge, dear Incision and Drainage, I went to see The Wrestler last night. Predominantly to answer the nagging question of what on earth happened to Mickey Rourke. Having missed Mr. Rourke's heyday only ever seeing Marissa Tomei in the buttock-clenchingly awful What Women Want, my expectations were not high. From the first minute, I was as stunned as if I'd just had a balsa wood chair smashed over my head. The characters were well-developed, multi-layered and complex, a fan myself actually caring about what happened to them from very early on. Sensational work by both Tomei, our new favourite friend, and yes. Rourke, but also, and this hasn't had much attention, Evan Rachel Wood, whose forgotten daughter character was understated and superb.
You know,
everybody, he concludes, does Marcus, should be thoroughly proud of themselves.
You had me until Evan Rachel Wood. The one weak link in the rest. You've seen the rest, right? Because you're nodding, says it right.
I thought she's the one weak.
It's the one, fact, it's not actually her fault. But the problem is, the one bit of that film that doesn't ring true is the he has to have a failed relationship with his daughter. And Evan Rachel Wood does the thing about looking at him while he's doing the emoting about how I should have been there for you and all that kind of stuff. But that's the one thing, if I was the editor, I would have gone, you know, Darren, the rest of it's absolutely kicking, but that bit, just ditch the Evan Rachel, and arrange these names in a... I never get it right. She's Evan Rachel, or is she Rachel Evan? She's Evan Rachel.
Evan Rachel. Pete
Rachel.
In Sheffield, just off to the cinema for a mammoth three-film fest. Rachel Getting Married, Milk and Assembly. So I wanted to send a quick message with regards to The Wrestler. I went to see it yesterday on Mark's recommendation last week and thought it was beautiful, tender and very tragic. Though I feel Mark's review perhaps should have included a slighter, larger warning. This is an incredibly sad film. There are moments when you feel you may, as a viewer, have to abandon the character, and it's a testament to both the wonderfully delicate direction and superb performance by Mickey Rourke that you don't. Still, probably the saddest film I think I have ever seen.
Well, that's really saying something. I mean,
contains
scenes of extreme emotional sadness. I think it's more tragic. I think it's more like the third act of Lear. Second time I've invoked Lear. Have you noticed that? But it's. I think it's very moving. But I think the thing that's missing from that is that it is Marissa Tomei's character who absolutely mediates. Because if it wasn't for the Marissa Tomei character, it would just be Mickey Rourke doing the "I could have been a contender" speech from On the Waterfront.
Let's squeeze this in. Defiance at 7.
Yes.
What?
Yes, very good. I can't even be bothered.
Beverly Hills Chihuahua at 6.
Beverly Hills Chihuahua, nothing like as bad as it could have been.
Bride Wars at 5.
Everything like as bad as it could have been.
My Bloody Valentine in 3D.
It's like the old one, except things come out of the screen at you. Lots of stuff comes out at the screen.
Roll very camp. Role yes. Models at 3.
Let's just quote James King. It's jam-packed with belly laughs and absolute genius. And and I had a row with him in the cinema about this. We were watching something. And then Edith Bowman apparently was talking about it on Radio 1. She said, I was sitting next to James King and some bloke was giving him a really hard time about his...
Some bloke?
Yeah.
Has she got no respect?
I certainly hope not.
£7 at number 2. Now, Andrew in Aberdeen, I'd like to say the Good Doctor's review of £7 was hampered. By the press pack he received, tricking him into thinking he was about to witness the greatest film twist since Miriam Margolyes turned out to be strong enough to take Arnold Schwarzenegger to the cleaners in End of Days. The film wasn't about the obvious twist everyone knew was coming from the first 15 minutes. It was about the struggle of a man trying to atone for sins past and having the moral strength to carry through with his plan, albeit a crazy one. The ultimate goal of this movie is to tug on the heartstrings of the audience that watches, and it did this to full effect with the people I saw it with. Might I suggest the Good Doctor attend another showing of this film, putting the twist out of his mind and focusing more on the emotional journey of Will Smith's character?
Right, you're asking me to see £7 again? Not for all the tea in China. No, I saw it once. That was fine, right? I waded through the treacle once. I ain't going back again. I'm not going to sit there and watch the poisonous squid get wheeled on in a mysterious tank again so that everyone in the audience go, "Ooh, what's with the squid? I wonder what's going to happen with the squid. I can't figure out." And also, I'm terribly sorry about this. It's not just a matter of if you take away the twist, because, you know, there are films in which the twist is obvious, but it doesn't make any difference. The film holds up. But £7, everything about it is going, "Ooh, what's the mystery?
Are they going?
If the press pack had said at the very, very beginning, you know, it's okay. Obviously, you can reveal the twist because it ain't a twist. It still would have been a duff movie.
And the UK's number one is, of course, Slumdog Millionaire. And it's
you're going to do that all the time.
Well,
now.
That's the way he does it in the film. Who wants to be a millionaire? It's got millionaire in the title, but you can't say he says millionaire.
No, but that's
or milliner. Slumdog Milliner.
I think Anna Kapoor's performance is absolutely great.
And Terry in Norwich. Dear Good Doctor and Bad Doctor. Last night,
Slumdog Squarepants.
I went to my local multiplex to see Slumdog Millionaire. I can't even say Slumdog now. I was worried that because of all the exposure and rave reviews and the expectation that they bring, I might be disappointed. I could not be more wrong. Good. There are so many aspects and moments that I could rave about. I have not the will to list them all, which is a relief. It's a film that stays with you even several hours after seeing it, and I'm remembering and appreciating the scenes and struggling to think about anything else. Not a very productive day at work, to be honest. In this award season, where many films are full of actors practically pleading for an Oscar with their acting, I'd like to give Dev Patel a mention. His understated performance, on which the whole story hangs, makes Jamal both believable and impossible not to like. And Kath in Cheshire, went to see Slumdog last night. Firstly, I'd like to thank you for underlining the completely inappropriate marketing campaign.
Good.
Secondly, I would urge anyone to go and view it on a big screen, because although I feel it'd be fine when it's on the small screen, there is no way that the sheer size of the slums and the noise and madness could be appreciated as much.
It's absolutely true. And when Anthony Dodd-Mantle shot it, he clearly shot it to be seen in the cinema. And when Aaron, you know, scored it, he clearly scored it to be heard in the cinema. It is a cinema experience. Plus, it is one of those movies that seeing it with an audience probably does change the way the film looks. I mean, I think that one of the reasons that they're managing to get away with that feel-good campaign is that people come out in a good mood. And that is something which is different when you're in a group of people.
Dear Ooh, and I know, saw Slumdog last night, says Ben in London. Very strange now.
I know.
Which one are you?
I'm
I know then. Saw Slumdog last night. I'm completely in two minds about it, but with your help, I can come down definitely on one side. Let me explain. There's a key line where Mrs. Slumdog says to Mr. Slumdog, either, I thought we'd be together only in death.
In debt.
Or,
in debt.
I thought we'd only be together in debt. My inability to distinguish this line means I'm not sure whether the film is a glorious celebration of the ability of love to conquer all obstacles, even beyond this life, or a miserable capitalist tract about how only money can bring true happiness. Yeah. Please help.
The line, as far as I understood it, and I've seen it a couple of times, is together only in debt. And as you were saying that, I thought you said to overcome all lobsters.
Maybe that's what it is.
I mean, I do believe in the power of transcendent love to overcome all lobsters and indeed other shellfish and invertebrate sea-dwelling animals.
But what's first on the review table?
We're going to do the Michael Sheen double whammy.
Oh, OK, so it's a bit of Underworld, bit of Frost Nixon.
It's a bit of Frostbite.
Mark in 5 says, Dear Cheese and Pickle, I told my wife I'd love to see Frost Nixon and I'm a big Michael Sheen fan. She said, do you mean the guy from Apocalypse Now? What's to be done with her?
Very good.
You're not faded up, which is quite a nice place to be, actually. Bill in Newton Abbot, Dear Death and the Maiden, went to see Frost Nixon. I was appalled by the historical inaccuracy therein. In one shot, Frost is shown flying back from Australia in a Qantas jumbo jet. But when the scene cuts to the interior of the plane, all the cabin decor is clearly labelled British Airways. Cue Dr. Death telling me I should get out more, and he's probably right. As for everyone else who might not spot that, let's talk about this wonderful Sheen double bill.
I have to say that I didn't spot that, OK? So, as you probably know, it's the adaptation of the Peter Morgan stage play about the famous televisual meeting between David Frost and Richard Nixon. I saw the play at the Donmar, in which it had Michael Sheen and Frank Langella on stage, and now, of course, filmed by Ron Howard, who, when he's good, is very good. We're talking about things like Splash and Grand Theft Auto, and when he's bad, he ends up directing The Da Vinci Code, and indeed the sequel to The Da Vinci Code, The Da Vinci Code being one of the most boring films ever made. So, all you need to know...
Not as boring as The Piano, though.
No, but then almost nothing in the world is as boring as The Piano.
We agree.
What's happened, if you were listening to the show yesterday, you would know that during the Oscar nominations, the Frank Langella winning streak continued, in that he's the guy who's picking up the awards attention, and Michael Sheen not. Now, I looked into this a little bit, because one of the things that often happens when you're sort of trying to position a movie for awards is to do with supporting actor or leading actor and supporting actor. Witness, for example, what happened with Katie Winsett and the fact that at the Golden Globes she won for supporting actor for The Reader. She's now nominated for supporting actress for The Reader. She's now nominated for leading actress for The Reader and not nominated for Revolutionary Road, which of course she won. So obviously they went, well, we don't want her to be competing against herself. Let's have her down as supporting actress.
I was listening yesterday. I'm confused now.
Yeah, it's to do with the supporting and the lead categories. Right. You were with this yesterday. How can you have forgotten it? It was only 24 hours ago.
I know.
Was Katie Winsett a supporting actress in real life in The Reader?
Of course not.
No, of course not. She was clearly the leading
Ridiculous
actress, and yet she won a Golden Globe for it. And she's now been nominated in the Oscars as leading actress. At the BAFTAs, she's nominated for leading actress for both that and Revolutionary Road. But so I wondered whether what happened in the case of Michael Sheen was that maybe they tried to position him as a supporting actor, which I think they could have done. It would have been an easy card to play, but it also would have been actually wrong, because I think it's a bit strange that Frank Langella is getting all this attention as far as the awards are concerned and not Michael Sheen, because it is absolutely a two-header, and I think that to prioritise one actor over the other is a mistake. Party Political Broadcast ends there. Here's a clip of Michael Sheen and Frank Langella with equal weight breathing life into Frost and, indeed, Nixon.
Why didn't you call the police and have them arrested? Isn't that just a cover-up of another kind of...
Well, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have just called the feds into my office and said, hey, there's the two men. Haul them down to the dock, fingerprint them, and then throw them in the can. I'm not made that way. These men, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, I knew their families. I knew them since they were just kids. Oh, yeah, but you know, politically, the pressure on me to let them go, that became overwhelming. So I did it. I cut off one arm, then I cut off the other, and I'm not a good butcher. And I have always maintained what they were doing, what we were all doing, was not criminal. Look, when you're in office, you gotta do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation and then do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry?
That's what I believe.
Now, one of two things will be true. You'll either be absolutely transfixed by that because, as for me, the idea of, you know, Nixon being grilled at all, both literally and metaphorically, is a thrilling subject. Or you'll think it's two blokes sitting in a room talking, okay? I think, obviously, that anything to do with Nixon is inherently interesting, and that's why, you know, I'm predisposed to like Frost Nixon. And I've read a few reviews of it, not only in the paper, which you always accuse me of, you know, being the only paper that I read, saying, you know what, it's terribly theatrical, and it is, in the end, a bunch of blokes sitting in a room talking about stuff. And it's absolutely so much not the case that that's what's going on.
It's actually so much not the case.
Yes.
Are you 15? What you should have done is, it's actually so much not the case. That's how you should have said
should
it. It's actually so much like
you've just so not like not got a life, honestly. But
such a random thing
yeah,
to say.
It is right. No, it is. But it's like Frost Nixon, right? You know, yeah, all right. I can't. No, I can't even do it because the thing is, I can't do infantile in the way
it.
That you do. Yeah, you, no, you started it. No, you started it. No, you said it first. Am I bothered? In the stage play.
Meanwhile,
back in the real world, in the stage play, what was interesting was that it's a televisual confrontation between, you know, the angel and the devil. I mean, but it's interesting because, of course, David Frost was not seen as this kind of great heavyweight. He was actually seen as a lightweight. He was, you know, interviewing the Bee Gees one day, and the next day he was going to do this, you know, take on Nixon, who was the great roving beast of the Western world, wounded and out of office by that point, but still the devil. And the question was whether or not it would ever be able to, you know, to pin Nixon down to anything approaching an apology or a confession. And, of course, what the conceit of the play is that during the course of this, it's like a wrestling match, it's like a boxing match between the two of them. Somehow, Frost, who is assumed by Nixon to be a complete lightweight, manages to get in a couple of sucker punches that in which we see Nixon reveal himself to be what he really was. Now, when I saw it on stage, the interesting thing about it was it's a play about a televisual confrontation, and it's staged in a way that was oddly televisual. When you see it as a film, and it is, and Ron Howard has said this, it's absolutely about the power of the close-up. It's about the way in which television gets into somebody's face and shows you things that you don't see, you know, in other sort of walks of life. And this is particularly important because Nixon was one of those people whose relationship with television was kind of confusing. I mean, politics has all been changed by the fact that if you know how to work television, everyone thinks you're okay. And if you don't know how to work television, everyone doesn't. That's so much what's at the heart of Frost Nixon. So it's not just that I like it because I'm interested in the idea of Nixon, you know, getting his comeuppance. It's interesting if you're interested in the media, if you're interested in the way interviews work, if you're interested in that idea of the close-up. And Howard's direction is very unfussy. He doesn't do that stuff that some people feel the need to do whenever they take a stage play, which is, oh, we're putting it on screen. I know. Let's go to space. Let's have lots of travelogue for this. Put some of it up the side of a mountain because otherwise people will say it's stagey. It's almost as if what he's done is said, look, it's not that it's stagey, it's that it's televisually. And that's, you know, its actual natural home is neither the stage nor the cinema, but is oddly television. And what Howard's managed to do is to make the televisual cinematic in the same way, I think, that Redford did with Quiz Show. On the question of the performances, Frank Langella is brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. But every bit as brilliant as him is Michael Sheen. And what Michael Sheen does with that performance is to absolutely walk the line between being what you know David Frost's mannerisms were. I mean, he came on the programme here and he talked about doing that thing about the first thing when you come on, you do hello, good evening, and well, so that you get the kind of gag thing out the way. And then you kind of rack it down. You know, you start turned up to 11 and then you rack it down. And you know what? That's exactly what happens. It's like he gets the mannerisms out the way at the beginning, and then it settles back into something which said, okay, you believe me as Frost, now come with me. Come with me now on this, on the journey that this character goes on. And I was completely sold on him. And
it's an interesting dynamic of an interview. Study with the dynamic of an interview. First two interviews, Frost doesn't do any work. Does some work for the third one. But there's something organic. There's something that happens in that last interview. He's certainly cornered because Frost has done the prep, but I think there's an element to which Frost gets lucky.
Oh,
that
no, I
suddenly
think
Nixon has decided to expose himself and apologise. I'm not quite sure that he had to. I'm not sure it's entirely explained why he had to apologise at that point.
I think you're absolutely right that the dynamic of the play and the film doesn't say, actually, that Frost got him. It says that he kind of did it to himself. It's the wounded thing. For the third time this today, it's like Leah. It's the wounded beast.
You and your Shakespeare.
No, I'm sorry, but it is. It's funny that those things have all come together. And there is a comparison between it and The Wrestler, and there is a comparison between it and Quiz Show. And I'm just very disappointed that Michael Sheen hasn't got recognised at the awards in the way that I'm sure the audience are recognising him, because people aren't coming out of that film and going, you know, that Frank Langella guy was great.
We built this section of the programme as the Sheen double bill, but the second Sheen film's going to have to wait because we're late for news and sport already. Just some Frost Nixon comments. Chris, on this, dear Clough and Taylor, saw Frost Nixon a few weeks back in New York, loved it, especially Frank Langella. However, I think a mention should go to Kevin Bacon.
Who's always great.
Who's back to his Woodsman best.
Yes, and also Chris's to Toby opinion. Jones.
Simon, who's of course still Dick Cheney, really.
No, he's being Swifty Lazar. But
I know he is.
Are you saying there's an element of Dick Cheney and Swifty Lazar?
Simon
says... Doesn't invade anywhere, does he?
On this is Simon. I saw a preview of Frost Nixon on Tuesday. It's good, but the story is not complex enough to sustain the film duration. Frank Langella delivers a clever performance in the sense he adopts typical Nixon mannerisms. Therefore,
the story is not complex enough. The story,
sorry, Simon,
of
your email now doesn't count.
I mean, I'm sorry. How do you even begin to answer? The story is not complex enough. The story of Richard Nixon being on television is not complex enough. I give up. I actually give up.
No, you don't. So don't even go there.
That's from banging my head on the.
Funny that. I've just logged on to View's website, Simon, and the poster for Frost Nixon is on the homepage. Michael Sheen looks like himself. However, Frank Langella picture, taken in black and white, looks like our unbeloved leader, Nixon Brown. Now, there's a combination, says Paul. So we'll do the other Michael Sheen film, which is Underworld 3. Also coming up, Valkyrie, which we have to do, and
yes.
Milk.
All and Rachel getting married, and there's just so much stuff. So we'll try and keep them tight.
Let's keep on going, and if we keep going beyond 4 o'clock, it won't matter. 5 Live 85058 mail at bbc.co.uk. Like this one from Debbie and Paul Raftery in Bolton. Dear Troy and Gabriella, whilst looking at the Oscar nominations on CFAX last night, thanks for tuning in yesterday. Yep. We noticed that a film entitled Hello Boy 2, The Golden Army, is a contender in one of the categories. Is this an error on behalf of the BBC, or has Del Toro perhaps produced a camped-up, carry-on-style version of Hellboy, which is yet to hit our shores? We're eagerly awaiting the next in the franchise, possibly Hello Boy 3. Oh, you are awful. Oh, I know. Thanks for the entertainment. Debbie and Paul, thank you. Blimey, you've got so much stuff coming out. Is this always a particularly busy week?
Well, it's because we're coming up to the awards. You know how this works.
I know, but it just seems particularly busy this week. Chris in Cambridge, dear Mary and Pippin, just thought I would write to thank you and the good doctor for finally providing me with an effective antidote to my fear of flying. Last week I was coming back from Bologna. The trusty BA plane, complete with pilot who sounded like Biggles, decided to start pogoing, shimmying, banging and clumping, which unfortunately always puts me in mind of that bit in Apollo 13. Nothing was working, not even the little bottles of red wine. Then I remembered my iPod and the healthy number of podcasts stored therein. I have to congratulate Dr. Kermode. His impression of Arnold Schwarzenegger is the perfect antidote to flying. Keep up the wittertainment. Don't forget the podcast. You can subscribe to that. We're also live and streamed, so you can watch The Good Doctor talk about Michael Sheen's other offering this week, which is slightly different.
Which is Underworld Rise of the Lycans, and we should tell the nation that you did say outside, what is a Lycan?
Well,
it's in lycanthrope. You know Harry Potter?
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Well, you know, werewolf, Lycan.
Okay.
Yeah, fine. And also, it enables me to say me no Lycan. There was one of the very first
me no Popeye.
Yeah, there was a film called I am a Camera, for which one of the reviews was me no Leica, L-E-I-C, which is very funny. So in the case of this, me no Lycan. So Michael Sheen was on the program the other day. Well, a while back, wasn't he?
Yeah, a couple of weeks back.
Okay. We don't have a clip of Underworld. I've only just seen the wretched thing because they didn't show it to us. But here's a clip of Michael Sheen talking about listening to you and me.
At some point, I remember thinking, they're going to review this film that I'm now making. What if Mark and Simon hate it? And I will be so addicted to these podcasts that I'll have to listen to them slagging me off about this film.
It is an uncomfortable experience. But then actors have come in and said and confessed how much they want to punch Mark.
I don't. I want to go up to him and give him a lovely hug and a little tickle under the chin.
Do you?
Yeah.
What? Because you're afraid he might say something bad about the film?
No, because, I love it because he's so honest about what he likes. And he says what he feels about everything. And whether he likes it or not, it's still really entertaining to listen to him. So I just think he's fantastic.
So we say hello to Michael Sheen.
Hello,
who's
Michael
listening
Sheen.
To this podcast,
yep.
Listening to him talking about how he's afraid of listening to the podcast.
It's weird, isn't
talking
it?
About him.
It is weird, isn't it? It's a strange. It's like a loops within loops. But I think we've said pretty thoroughly. Michael Sheen, Frost Nixon, great stand up. Actually, Michael Sheen in The Queen. I always thought that movie should have been called The Queen and Mr. Blair because he was in at least half of what was great about it, and he was the one who should have been up there getting the gongs along with Helen Mirren. Underworld, Rise of the Lycans, it's rubbish. I mean, it is just rubbish. Now, on the scale of how rubbish is it, the general feeling from the assembled backpack in screen one of the Trocadero this morning at 10 past 12 was that it was probably the least rubbish of the Underworld franchise. That doesn't mean it's not rubbish, but it's...
So they're getting better.
Well, yes.
Well, that's good. That's an encouragement. That's Michael. Well done. You get
terribly boring, but it's less terribly boring, perhaps, than the others. Now, there are the stuff that you need to know about it is, it looks like all those goth movies, vampires, werewolves, rather dodgy CGI because they haven't quite figured out how the werewolves run. Bit at the end that looks like the orcs storming the castle in Lord of the Rings, but not as good. But impressively, Michael Sheen does an awful lot of walking around with his chest out, okay? There's one fantastic scene in which he has a sensual moment with his lady love completely naked whilst hanging virtually over the edge of a castle cliff. And there's a lot of that going. And there's a lot of sort of Passion of the Christ flagellation and flailing and, all that sort of... So he spends a lot of time with his shirt off. And, it looks pretty good. It looks pretty good with his shirt off, and he spends a lot of time running around in leather trews. Well, those weird things are the leather trews with the sort of the do-up bit at the front, not like a zip fly or a button fly, but a bit of string, like goths wear. Never quite understood that, but apparently
it's a homoerotic thing going on, isn't it?
Well, I think that would be overstretching the word, but he does look good with his shirt off, and he does shout and suffer actually very well. His performance is perfectly fine, but the film's rubbish, and quite boring rubbish at that. Loved Frost Nixon though,
so that's fine. So that is the Frost double bill, and that's done. So Michael is, I think
he's
done
fine. He comes out of it absolutely with his head held high,
and of course he's about to be Brian Clough in The Damned United,
and he'll be great because he's just great in everything.
So look,
but was I clear that it is rubbish?
Yes,
good.
I think you made that absolutely clear.
Fine.
David Morrissey.
Yes.
Hello, David.
Hello, David.
Jason Isaacs.
Hello, Jason Isaacs.
Fairport Convention.
Very good. Charlotte from the Subways.
Stephen Fry, did I mention him?
No, hello, Stephen Fry. We've been a bit lax on the hellos recently.
I know. I think it all members of Focus.
Do you think it's withering on the vine?
No. Okay, absolutely. I think that we've proved Michael Sheen. We've just given him a very surreal moment. Yes. That Frost Nixon thing would never have happened, says Stephen Chester. It's a fable. Do you think Richard Nixon, by the way, is the most surprising Quaker of all time?
No.
Who's more surprising as a Quaker then?
You mean I have to name a more surprising Quaker in order to
disprove... Well, you said no, he's... I mean...
Well, no, he said, why is it surprising that he's a Quaker?
Because Quakers are famous for being calm and pacifist.
Right, and you're saying because he was mad and nuts.
And given
to invading places if
and
he
napalmed
felt like it.
Places, but apart, is he the only Quaker who's used napalm Probably yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, what else is new?
I'm sure there are other Quakers who've used napalm. I just can't think who they are.
I bet you he's the only napalming Quaker ever.
Right, let's throw it open to the listenership. Any other napalm-using Quakers, please let us know who they are. Milk, the biopic of Harvey Milk, starring Sean Penn, who, of course, is it's up for a number of nominations. We had the director and the writer of Milk.
One was boring, one was interesting.
Yeah, should we do an impression of how that went? I'll be the writer. Yeah, it's a really interesting story. I was really fascinated by it. And what I really wanted to do was get the audience engaged.
I'll be the director.
That this was, you know, the story of the first openly gay elected politician, which was really important. And it's so recent history, but people have forgotten about it. What do you say, Gus?
I'm on my BlackBerry.
Should we have a clip?
Yeah.
Is there anyone else here from the board today, Dan?
You're the only one who showed, I think.
Were you christened here?
I was, right here, St. Parish. My grandmother immigrated here when this was an Irish Catholic city, the city of St. Francis. But a lot's changed here since then, you know?
You're more like one of us now, an outsider.
You're not like most homosexuals, are you, Harvey?
Do you know a lot of homosexuals, Dan?
Hey, where do you stand on the psychiatric center that the city's been pushing into my district?
Well, I have to study it.
Okay, well, it was a key piece of my platform, you know, getting it out of my district. It only attracts arsonists, rapists, that sort of thing.
A campaign,
you know?
Promise.
A big one.
Sure.
A big one. What do you say we watch out for each other's interests? I would really like that.
Well, I'd like that too, Dan.
Well, good.
Josh Brolin is, of course, up for Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role, and he's absolutely terrific in the film. I mean, he really is very, very good indeed. I also think that Sean Penn's performance is convincing and solid and clearly heartfelt. My problem with Milk is fairly straightforward. It's that it is an extraordinary story. It was, of course, told in the documentary The Times of Harvey Milk, which has just been reissued on DVD and which Gus Van Sant said was a kind of key inspiration for him when he first wanted to do the film. It is, however, an almost scared mainstream movie. It's almost as if he said, look, the story is the whole thing. I don't want to alienate anybody. I don't want to do anything inventive or exciting or artistic with it. I want to play it completely straight. And the result, unfortunately, is rather, in my opinion, and you've seen it, so you can disagree with me, like a television. No.
You think that's worth it, do you?
What?
Disagreeing with you.
No, I'd be interested to hear somebody else's opinion.
No, you wouldn't.
No, I'd be quite interested. Well, no, maybe everybody else would be interested.
Right.
So I think that the problem with it is that it is a television film which has got some great performances in it, and the story itself is so bold and so interesting and so important, and particularly, you know, times being as they are at the moment, it's very, very important that people understand, you know, how history has been formed recently by characters, for example, like Harvey Milk. And it's very, very important because it's a story of somebody standing up for gay rights and standing up for, you know, the right of the individual alongside union rights and all these other things. And it's, you know, and effectively putting his life on the line because he, as the film demonstrates, starts off by narrating his own sort of, you know, death note because he thinks that he's putting himself in the line of fire, and genuinely he is. I still wish it had been a more adventurous film. I wish it had been a more experimental film. I wish it was less like the Gus Van Sant stuff, like Good Will Hunting, which I find terribly boring. And in fact, I just thought it needed to be more of a film because it does feel terribly televisual to me. Simon?
I think it's worth seeing entirely to see Sean Penn, who puts in an... So I don't think the movie should win Best...
Do you think it should
film,
be up Sean, for Best Film?
No, not really, I think Sean Penn should be up for Best Actor because I think he looks extraordinary. Here's Robert in Milton Keynes. Seen both Milk and Frosty Nixon this week. As a gay man in my 40s, I found Milk profoundly moving.
Yes.
And I'm finding it hard to detach my involvement in the film from the quality of the movie. On the other hand, I found Frosty Nixon interesting but not involving.
Okay, I think that the story of Harvey Milk is moving and interesting.
And Sean Penn...
No, he's good.
Extraordinary.
No, he is good. He is. I don't know that he's extraordinary. I think he's good. I mean, it's a fairly safe portrayal. I mean, it doesn't. It's not a kind of, you know, light and shade portrayal. It's a fairly straightforward heroic portrayal. There's not a lot, you know, to risk, and he's doing the job perfectly well. But I'm not sure that he's. I'm not sure that what he's doing is stunning, and I certainly don't think the film itself is anything other than solidly mediocre.
So,
shall we move on to...
Well, I think it should be Valkyrie, ahead of which this from Derek, who says, yeah. Dear Romper and Stomper, which one do you...
I'll be Stomper.
This morning I had a report claiming that a Sex in the City sequel was going ahead, and even more depressingly, plans to make it into a trilogy.
Blimey.
We're waiting to hear the Good Doctor's opinion on Valkyrie not being made in the German language, but also not with German accents
yes.
either.
Well, let's hear a clip of Valkyrie. This is Tom Cruise, and I think in this clip it's Bill Nighy.
You've been promoted Chief of Staff for the Reserve Army.
Excuse me?
Congratulations.
I am busy with other things.
Unfortunately, your nocturnal activities don't count as service to the Reich.
I'll refuse a promotion.
You'll do no such thing. Treskow may have left you in charge of the operation, but in this world, I still outrank you. You will accept the promotion. You'll have real access to Hitler, his advisors, his schedule. We need this. I've looked through your changes to Valkyrie. I approve. I'll need you to get Hitler to sign it.
I've thought this through at a great length. The whole issue about whether if people are speaking in English, whether they should speak with their own accents, whether because you know, you've got an American accent, you've got an English accent, you've got some of the characters appear to be drifting slightly into other parts of the film, into German accents, and other places you've got German actors who are... So it's a, it, there's a kind of Tower of Babel thing going on. Now, as we know, in the case of The Reader... We had Kate Winslet doing, you know, the sort of slightly German inflected accent all the way through, which particularly bothers me because, of course, if you you know, do they sound, do they have accents when they're speaking in each, in their native language? The answer to that is no. There is a solution to this because, you know, there's been an awful lot of stuff on the internet. Why aren't they speaking in German accents? Should they be speaking in German accents? What, you know, why is he American? Why is he English? Simple answer is just to do the film in German and everybody get used to watching films in foreign languages and reading subtitles like the rest of the world
there's
does.
There's no point in suggesting
there
that
is.
Because it isn't going to happen.
Yeah, no, there is a point suggesting it.
A lot of people won't
century.
Go and see it.
Yeah, everybody said that capitalism wasn't going to collapse. And you know what? Here it is happening around us.
No,
so,
it hasn't, actually.
All I'm saying is there is a simple answer to all of this, which is that we should all get used to the fact that movies don't have to be in English. That said, I think that the Valkyrie is a better film than I'd expected to be. Somebody wrote in saying, you know, am I going to kick it? It's odd because you know the outcome of the story. You know, they didn't. Because it's about a plot to assassinate Hitler, which is, you know, based on a true story. And as you know, it obviously didn't happen because I think we... Although, funnily enough, I did see Apollo 13 in a cinema with somebody who was then serving as the Radio 1 film critic. And
who
she did
that?
It was... I'm not being rude about this because it was an age thing. It was Wendy Lloyd, who I actually liked very much. And at the end of the film, she said it was really exciting, particularly since I didn't know how it ended. But then that's because she was half my age, you know, so...
Just put that on pause. Rick Mann in London did Tintin and Snowy, usually podcast listener. I'm listening live today.
Yeah.
A rare Friday off work. Can I add to Mark's often-told that-would-never-happen Eraserhead story with an oft-told story in the Mann family? My sister came out of Apollo 13 and said, you know what? That could really happen, couldn't it?
Very good. Very good. Very, very good.
Nicely worked in.
But in the case of Valkyrie, I mean, I know there's been a lot of sort of flack thrown around about it, but let's not get completely distracted by the people speaking in, you know, in American accents and English accents. Does it work as a thriller? Does it work as a thriller, particularly when what you know, the outcome of the thriller is that it didn't happen? I mean, there's a Day of the Jackal thing going on there as well, obviously. And the answer is, oddly, yes, a lot better than I would have expected. I mean, it's no great work. It's a B-movie. It's a pulpy B-movie. It's a kind of, you know, it's an action-adventure film. That's what it is. I don't think it holds any great water as a serious work. But, oddly enough, I thought that Bryan Singer made a pretty good fist of making it exciting and edge of the seat and sort of, you know, good Saturday afternoon entertainment, which it so clearly could have failed to do since... We all know the outcome of the story. I mean, there was a level of tension involved in the assassination plot, which was surprising, considering we know the outcome of the story. So actually, nothing like as bad as people have been suggesting.
Quick point from Donald in Dublin, just on the subject of accents and language, as it has come up. Dear Doctors Pretorius and Frankenstein, you were a little puzzled, both of you. During Defiance, the actor's Russian dialogue is sometimes spoken in English and sometimes left untranslated. This is not the case. When the characters are speaking Yiddish, the actors deliver the lines in English. All the Russian dialogue remains in Russian. I hope that is clear. He also concludes, I'm glad Mark saw Benjamin Button for the fatuous, award-gobbling, emotionally arid bore that it is. Let's fit in Rachel getting married.
So very quickly, we haven't got time to do a clip, but of course I'm mentioning it because it's out this week and also because Anne Hathaway is up for a performance by a lead actress in a leading role for the Oscars, and there was that funny story that she was, well not funny, weird story, that when the Golden Globes happened, just before, the reason Katie Winslet was so taken aback when she won Best Actress was because there had been an apparent leak from the Golden Globes website that somehow an asterisk had appeared by Anne Hathaway's name. People said, oh, look, that means she's won. And of course, it turned out that she hadn't, but people are so inclined to believe that rune reading in Hollywood that everyone was surprised that she hadn't. Now, this is a Jonathan Demme movie. The story is Anne Hathaway. This is serious Anne Hathaway. You know the other Anne Hathaway, which is Princess Diaries, all the rest of it. Then there's the Havoc Anne Hathaway and the serious Anne Hathaway. Story is she's coming out of rehab. She's just rehabilitated herself in time to go back to her family home in order, where she can mess up Rachel, her sister's wedding. It's directed by Jonathan Demme, and it's Jonathan Demme's done an awful lot of work recently with documentaries. He made that very good Jimmy Carter documentary. Of course, he's best known, I suppose, for making Silence of the Lambs, which I think was the first horror film, or the only horror film ever to win the Best Picture Oscar, if you count it as a horror film. It's made in the style of a wedding video. It looks very verite. It looks like they're all making the lines up as they go along. And there is something that's terribly realistic about it. It does absolutely have the smack of authenticity. And you do wonder, is that scripted? Are they making it up? How is that working? And that's impressive. My problem with it, put very simply, is this. I hate the characters. I hate all of them. I don't want to be around them at all. None of them. They're all self-indulgent, moaning, you know, whinging ninnies living in a big house with fantastically artisan connections, and I don't care. And there is one hideous melodramatic set piece which involves a dishwasher, and anyone who's seen it, I don't want to give it away. If you get to the dishwasher scene and you don't go, oh no, you're not going to play that card. Seriously.
Is the dishwasher better than the jellyfish?
The dishwasher, yeah. The dishwasher is the moment I went, no, that's fine. You do verite or you do melodrama, but don't do them both together.
Or was it really an asterisk that appeared next to Anne Hathaway?
Was it an asterisk?
Yeah, well, you said an asterisk, which took me in a whole different direction. And film of the week?
Well, Frost Nixon.
Obviously,
you know.
Frost Nixon.
No, I was wondering for a moment about Underworld, but...
But don't.
Don't.
Have a good weekend. Back on Monday at 1.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.